We'll hear argument next in case 19-635, Donald Trump versus Cyrus Vance. Mr. Sekulow?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. No county district attorney in our nation's history has issued criminal process against the sitting president of the United States, and for good reason. The Constitution does not allow it. Temporary presidential immunity is constitutionally required by Article 2, and accordingly, the Supremacy Clause defeats any authority the DA has under state law as to the president. The Second Circuit is wrong and should be reversed. If not reversed, the decision weaponizes 2,300 local DAs. An overwhelming number of them are elected to office and are thereby accountable to their local constituencies. The decision would allow any DA to harass, distract, and interfere with the sitting president. It subjects the president to local prejudice that can influence prosecutorial decisions and to state grand juries who can then be utilized to issue compulsory criminal process in the form of subpoenas targeting the president. This is not mere speculation. It is precisely what has taken place in this case and with the subpoena we challenge. In the argument just concluded, we asserted that the subpoenas did not serve a legitimate legislative purpose, and they were burdensome. Yet the DA copied almost verbatim the House Oversight Committee subpoena with an additional 13 words which seek the president's tax returns. How revealing. The exact same language utilized by two congressional committees would subsequently be copied by the New York County District Attorney, covering the exact same documents and sent to the exact same recipients, yet purportedly for two completely different reasons. Under Article 2, or the heightened scrutiny standard under Nixon, the subpoena we challenge today cannot survive. As the Second Circuit concluded and the DA represents, the president's being investigated for potential criminal violations in a state grand jury proceeding with a local DA issuing coercive criminal process against the president. This he cannot do. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Counsel, for all that, you don't argue that the grand jury cannot investigate the president, do you?
We did not seek to have an injunction, as was the case involving Vice President Agnew, in enjoining the grand jury. We have targeted the utilization of the temporary immunity here to the subpoena. That's correct.
Well, in other words, it's okay for the grand jury to investigate, except it can't use the traditional and most effective device that grand juries have typically used, which is the subpoena.
It can't use a subpoena targeting the president. And under his Article II responsibilities and the Supremacy Clause, that is our view would be inappropriate and unconstitutional. So we have not challenged the
I don't understand. Your theory in terms of distraction and all that would seem to go much farther than resisting the subpoena. I don't know why you don't resist the investigation in its entirety or why your theory wouldn't lead to that.
Well, our position is that criminal process against the president, and that's what we're talking about. That's what's before the court. Criminal process targeting the president is a violation of the Constitution. We did not seek to enforce an injunction or seek an injunction against the grand jury investigating the situation with the president.
You focus on the distraction to the president, but yes. I don't know why in Clinton versus Jones, we were not persuaded that the distraction in that case meant that discovery could not proceed. And, there are different things that distract different people, but I would have thought the discovery in a case like Clinton versus Jones, even though civil, would be distracting, as you argue the grand jury proceedings are here.
Well, Clinton versus Jones, of course, was in federal court. This is in state court. Clinton versus Jones was a civil case. This is a criminal case. And as this court noted on page 691 of its opinion, if, in fact, the Clinton versus Jones case had originated in a state court proceeding, it would raise different issues than separation of powers, concerns over local prejudice. And in footnote 13, this court said that any direct control by a state court over the president may implicate concerns that are different than the interbranch disputes under separation of powers. So it would be a...
Ms. Thomas?
Yes, counsel. A couple of questions. I'm interested in whether or not you can point us to some express language at the founding or during the ratification process that provides for this immunity?
Well, there's a couple. There was a colloquy between Vice President Adams and Senator Ellsworth, where they talked about process against the president, and they took the position that any process against the president would be constitutionally problematic. Thomas Jefferson, of course, wrote in the letters he had regarding subpoenas that were issued in the Burr trial that allowing local magistrates to bander about a sitting president from north to south and east to west would interfere with the president's responsibilities. And as this court just in the previous argument just stated, the burdensome nature of this is categorical. It's not, you can't just look at the one subpoena. It is the potential for 2,300 DAs, or just 1% of them, 23 DAs issuing process against the president. But the concern over interference from our founding with the president's responsibilities was discussed, and that's why in the Constitution there's process to deal with it.
Does it make a difference when a subpoena goes to a third party?
Certainly not here. Number one, the respondents have either forfeited or waived it. They have conceded in their brief that they are seeking the president's documents. These are the president's documents. He is the real party in interest, and he has the burden, including review with his counsel, over any existing privileges and what these documents might entail.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Thomas.
Justice Ginsburg?
We have said in the grand jury context that the public has a right to every man's evidence. Is it your position that that is save for the president, every man's evidence, save for persons protected by privilege, and there is no privilege involved here? These are non-privileged, non-confidential papers. So is the grand jury right to every man's evidence exclusive of the president, every man except the president? That's one question. And then I wanted you to answer specifically. Paula Jones has held that the president was not immune from civil suits for conduct occurring before he took office. If Paula Jones had sued in state court rather than federal court, would Clinton have had absolute immunity?
Well, this to the second question first, if I might, Justice Ginsburg, this court in Clinton against Jones said that if the case was brought in state court, it would raise different issues of concerns over local prejudice. It was different than the separation of powers issues at play. It was issues involving the Article II and the Supremacy Clause. So the court said that on pages 691 and footnote 13. With regard to every man's evidence, this court has long recognized that the president is not to be treated as an ordinary citizen. He has responsibilities. He is himself a branch of government. He is the only individual that is a branch of government in our federal system. So our position is that the Constitution itself, both in structure and text, supports the position that the president would be temporarily immune from this activity, from a state proceeding, while he is the president of the United States.
Justice Breyer?
Every man's evidence excludes the president.
If I may, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Ginsburg, it's not that it excludes the president. The president is not to be treated as an ordinary citizen, and this is a temporary immunity. This is for while the president's in office, and we think that is required by the Constitution. Thank you.
Justice Breyer.
Well, you make a point of the 2,300 district attorneys, but of course in Clinton v. Jones, there might be a million, I don't know, tens of thousands of people who might bring lawsuits. Perhaps all of them were unfounded, but they could file the paper. Why isn't it sufficient just to apply ordinary standards? I gather ordinarily, any person who gets a subpoena can come in and say it's unduly burdensome. And what counts as unduly burdensome for a doctor who's in the middle of an operation might be very different from a person who's a salesman. And similarly for the president, all the factors you raise could come in under the title unduly burdensome. So why not just go back? Let the president say, I'll show you precisely how this is burdensome. I'm going to spend time, effort, working all these things out, figuring out what they mean, etc. And if he shows undue burden and lack of connection, he wins, and otherwise not. That's true of every person. That's Clinton v. Jones. Why not the same here?
Justice Breyer, the hypothetical you just gave, I think, proves the point. By the time you were to prepare, review, analyze the various requests, just in these three cases that we have today, shows the burdensome nature. And then to require the President of the United States, who, and as you raised in your opinion, in a concurring opinion in Clinton versus Jones, that burden is being met just by us being here. But to require the President to have to respond to each and every state district attorney that would like
no,
to...
No, he would hire you, and he'd hire a lawyer to list what the burdens are. That wouldn't take a lot of time. And then he wouldn't be burdened, because you'd go in and say what the burdens are. And if you're right, you win that case. They are saying, the other side, there are no burdens here.
Well,
you say there are. So send it back and let them figure out what they are.
I think doing that establishes the problem with an analysis of a case-by-case analysis. For instance, in this very case, in this subpoena found on page 118A and 19 of the petition appendix, there's a list of documents that are extensive. You would have to meet with the President of the United States. I mean, could you imagine just for a moment, Justice Breyer, that I, and you said he, let's assume the President were to hire me, that I'm going to call the President of the United States today and say, I know you're handling a pandemic right now for the United States, but I need to spend a couple of 2 to 3 hours with you going over a subpoena of documents that are wanted by here, the New York County District Attorney. I know you're busy, but you go, can you carve
Justice,
me out 2 hours?
Justice Alito,
are there at least some circumstances in which the U.S. Constitution would permit a local prosecutor to subpoena records containing information about a sitting president? So think of this situation. Suppose that the prosecutor has good reason to believe that the records contain information that is not available from any other source about whether a third party committed a crime, and suppose that waiting until the end of the president's term would make the prosecution of that crime impossible or at least very difficult. Would you say that at least in that circumstance it would be permissible for the grand jury subpoena to be enforced?
In a state court proceeding, the issues of time and burden are still there. Now, in U.S. v. Nixon, that was a case where the president was a witness, and the documents were asked for, and that this court said it should be handed over. But in that case, it was very clear that the president was a witness, and the attorney, the independent counsel there, Leon Jaworski, specifically stated to this court that the president was not a target. So if we had a pure witness standpoint, while it's a different case, the same constitutional principles would be at play, but here we're talking about criminal process targeting a president.
Well, was the answer that that would be permissible if the prosecutor were willing to say that the president was not a target, whatever that means?
Well, it wouldn't mean that it's constitutionally permissible. It would raise different issues for the president to consider. But constitutionally, I think that I have to be very clear here. Constitutionally, under Article 2 and the Supremacy Clause, as to a state court proceeding here, we think even as a witness, it raises serious issues. Obviously, a very different case than this, but serious issues nonetheless.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Sotomayor?
Counsel, it seems that you're asking for a broadness of immunity that Justice Thomas pointed out is nowhere in the Constitution. And in fact, the Constitution protects against presidential interference with state criminal proceedings. It doesn't allow the president to pardon offenders for state prosecutions or state criminal convictions. And yet, I find it odd that you want us to rule that there's essentially an absolute immunity from investigative powers, the height of a state's police powers, and that we would permit a civil damages case by a private litigant, which we did in Clinton. Prosecutors have ethical obligations. With respect to grand jury investigations, they have to keep those investigations secret. They can be prosecuted if they leak that information. Don't we usually presume that state courts and state prosecutors act as they should and in good faith?
Even if you were to assume that...
If you let me finish. And doesn't the president always have the opportunity to show that a particular subpoena, in fact, was issued in bad faith? The president was given that opportunity here, and an affidavit, I understand, was filed under seal, setting forth the reasonable grounds for the investigation. I'm not sure why he's entitled to more immunity for private acts than he should be for public acts.
Well, he's the president of the United States. He is a branch of the federal government.
We only give judicial officers and congressional officers immunity for acts within their official capacity. If they don't, if judges sexually harass someone, we've said that's not within judicial functions, they can be sued. If congressmen do the same thing, they can be sued. So my question still comes, you're asking for a broader immunity than anyone else gets.
Well, we're asking for a temporary...
We have time for a brief answer, counsel?
I will. We're asking for temporary presidential immunity. I would point out that under New York state law, witnesses before a grand jury are not sworn to secrecy. They can state that they testified and what the nature of their testimony was. I'd also like to point out that there are hundreds of members of the United States Congress and 100 members of the United State Senate. There is one president. Thank you.
Justice Kagan?
So, Mr. Secretary, you've said that a number of times and made the point, which we have made, that presidents can't be treated just like an ordinary citizen. But it's also true, and indeed a fundamental precept of our constitutional order, that a president isn't above the law. From our first days, Chief Justice Marshall told Thomas Jefferson that he could be subpoenaed, he could be examined as a witness, he could be required to produce papers. And so I guess going back to Justice Breyer's question, why isn't the way to deal with these two things, that the president is special, but that the president is like an ordinary citizen in that he's subject to law, is to say the president can make these usual objections that a subpoena recipient can make about harassment or about burden, and the court, in reviewing those, of course, should take seriously the president's objections and treat those with a certain kind of sensitivity and respect due to somebody who is a branch of government. Why isn't that the right way to do it?
For two reasons. First, and I think the case here is the perfect example, here the district attorney copied verbatim the House Oversight Committee and Ways and Means Committee subpoena verbatim. So, and we were just discussing in the previous case the nature of that burden. For counsel, the president hiring counsel, for each time he could be subpoenaed as a witness, or in this particular case as a target, would raise a serious impact on the president's Article II functions. So we think a categorical approach, and it's very specific here, state process as to the president, targeting the president's documents in a criminal proceeding should be prohibited.
Justice Gorsuch?
Counsel, I'd like to return to the question of Clinton versus Jones and how you would have us distinguish it. Yes, it took place in federal court, but it was a civil case. And as has been pointed out, others, there could have been multiple versions of that in multiple different districts across the country. So what's different about that? How do we avoid the conclusion there that the president wasn't subject to some special immunity, but here is?
I think the nature of the case that we're dealing with here is not in a vacuum itself. There are other cases that the president is dealing with at the same time. So what may have been a situation for President Clinton with a lawsuit, we have multiple litigation going on, including with the New York Attorney General. So I think the Supremacy Clause issue and the Article II issue here is pronounced, as this court alluded to, in Clinton against Jones for that very reason, this idea that local prejudice would impact the president. So the idea that we would wait until there's more of these, we're already here on three cases involving multiple subpoenas, much of which covers the same documentation. So I think it in fact, Justice Gorsuch, proves the point. We're here because the House has asked for documents that now the district attorney is asking for. So we are seeing that in real time, the burdensome nature of what's happening here.
How is this more burdensome, though, than what took place in Clinton versus Jones? I guess I'm not sure I understand.
Well, there's a big distinction between a defendant in a civil case and a principal in a criminal case here by the state district of the local DA.
Let me stop you there. Yes. They sought the deposition of the president while he was serving. Here, they're seeking records from third parties.
But they're his records from third parties, Justice Gorsuch. The third party is simply the agent custodian of the president's tax returns on the president's statement of financial conditions. So these are the president's documents that they're asking. And what's to stop them from seeking a deposition of the president or, for that matter, asking the president to appear before a grand jury? Because if the official versus unofficial was the deciding factor, and our view is that the initiation of process here interferes with the president's official duty, but if there was going to be this unofficial official distinction put in place, well, then what stops the local district attorney from having the president testify, having the president tried?
This is Justice Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and good afternoon, Mr. Sekulow.
Good afternoon.
Just following up on Justice Gorsuch, just explain, if you can, the rationale for having one rule for criminal and another rule for civil. Just assume there's one criminal investigation, that's it. And just explain the rationale for a different rule there.
Well, it's not that it's a different rule because, in this case, because it's within the context of a state proceeding, you have Article II concerns, and it's the Supremacy Clause issues, as this court alluded to in Clinton against Jones, that create the issues of concern about local prejudice. But the criminal nature of it creates a burden very distinct from a civil case, to be clear. The idea that you are the subject or a target of a criminal case being brought against you is very different than a civil suit where at the end of the day it results in monetary damages, not a loss of liberty. So there's a big distinction between a civil case and a criminal case in that regard, and I think that impacts the standard upon which this court should be looking at the president's temporary presidential immunity. We're talking about stopping a process targeting the president, this subpoena targeting the president. That's what we're talking about here. It is that burden that is our concern.
I think the other side says that the position you're articulating is a bit more consistent with Justice Breyer's concurrence in Clinton versus Jones than with the majority opinion. In his concurrence, he said that judges hearing a private civil damages action against a sitting president may not issue orders that could significantly distract a president from his official duties. And it's pointed out that that language was not in the majority opinion. What do you think about how we should assess that?
Civil discovery versus criminal processes are two very distinct processes. And in a civil context, in a civil proceeding, we have the federal rules of civil procedure in the federal court that govern how that process goes forward, and federal judges can take into various considerations, especially dealing with the president. This is a state proceeding initiated by the local district attorney against the sitting president of the United States. So our concern here is this: the nature of the proceeding itself is why we view categorically that a subpoena targeting the president and his records here
How do you deal with statute of limitations issues?
Well, the statute of limitation issues, of course, are decided under New York state law, and under New York state law, there would be procedures that could be utilized if, in fact, the DEA were to elect to start a process like that, or if there were to eventually be action. But I need to say
thank
something.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
General Francisco?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. At a minimum, a local prosecutor should have to show he really needs the president's personal records to subpoena them for two reasons. First, as the court suggested in Clinton against Jones, state proceedings can pose a greater threat to the presidency. The 2,300 prosecutors across the country necessarily place more emphasis on local interests than national ones. A special needs standard ensures that federal courts balance the prosecutor's local need for information against national interests, including the president's need to do his job. Second, ordinary grand jury rules are not designed to protect Article II interests. That's why in Nixon, the court held a federal prosecutor had to show a demonstrated specific need for the information sought. A local prosecutor should at least be required to meet the same standard. As the court has repeatedly said, in no case of this kind would a court be required to proceed against the president as against an ordinary citizen. And here the district attorney hasn't tried to meet the special needs standard.
General Francisco, we just heard Mr. Sekulow argue in favor of an absolute standard. No circumstances, no how. Your position is that, as you say, at a minimum, the special needs test must be met. Of course, Mr. Sekulow is representing Mr. Trump. You're representing the United States. You're arguing for a more flexible standard. So what was wrong with Mr. Trump's position?
Your Honor, I actually think that Mr. Sekulow makes a very strong argument on the immunity issue. We just don't think it's one that the court needs to address, at least until the prosecutor argues and attempts to meet the special needs standard. Here, since the prosecutor hasn't argued and isn't arguing before this court that he meets the special needs standard, there's no reason for the court to address the broader immunity question, and it's the court's ordinary processes to try to avoid those broader and more difficult questions when possible. And here we think that the special needs standard would fully resolve this case at this stage of the proceedings.
Well, in a typical case with adequate allegations to say that the standard's implicated, you would say that it goes before a court and the court will examine whether or not the criteria you talk about, which I gather is the test under Nixon, are met. And under Mr. Sekulow's standard, that would not immediately go before the court. He was looking for a ruling from us saying that he's absolutely immune, so the court would have no business addressing such a case. That's a very significant difference.
Well, Your Honor, I think that in both instances, the argument would be available to an article. You'd be able to make that argument to an Article II federal court. Under our argument, if the court found that the prosecutor hadn't met the Nixon special needs standard, it wouldn't need to address the broader immunity question. If it did find that the district attorney met the special needs standard, it would have to then address the broader immunity question. And all we are saying is that unless and until the special need issue is addressed at the threshold, there's no need to address the broader immunity question in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Thomas?
Yes. General Francisco, you mentioned the level of threat to the president or burden on the president. How do we determine that when it's too much?
Well, Your Honor, here I think there are a couple of things that you can take into account. First, the fact that we're in state court I think is quite significant. Local prosecutors are necessarily going to put more emphasis on local interests than national ones. It simply reflects the manner in which they rise to office through elections by local, relatively homogenous political communities. And in New York State, I would also add that the trial court judges are elected in a similar way. So there you've already got this risk of local prejudice. And so what the special needs standard does is that it ensures that there's a federal court that's available to balance the local interests against the national ones, including the president's need to do his job. And then secondly, it also has to do with the ordinary grand jury rules that would apply to a local prosecutor exercising his authority. Those rules were not designed to, and they're not sufficient to protect Article II interests, since under ordinary grand jury rules, a district attorney never has to make a particularized showing of need. Instead, the burden is on the witness to show that the subpoena can have no conceivable relevance to any plausible subject of an investigation. Now, that is a perfectly appropriate standard in the ordinary case, but the reason why Nixon applied the special needs standard above and beyond the ordinary rules of criminal procedure was because the court recognized that the president is the sole person in whom all Article II powers are vested. And so he is entitled to a measure of protection above and beyond the ordinary rules. And the special needs standard is one of those measures of protection. To put point back to Justice Breyer's very persuasive concurrence in Clinton against Jones, I think Justice Breyer correctly predicted that this court would need to develop special protective procedures precisely for the president in the context of litigation like this.
Justice Ginsburg?
You stress that the states are subordinate sovereigns they are subject to the Supremacy Clause, but you don't give any credit at all to the 10th Amendment and the reserve powers of the state. That's one question that I have. And as far as the impact of the president is concerned, I think there's no case more dramatic than the Nixon tapes. Devastating impact on the president. He resigned from office, but yet that was okay. So I really don't get it.
So, Your Honor, in terms of the 10th Amendment, all we're saying is that Article II vests all executive power in a single president of the United States. He is the sole person in whom all executive power is vested, and so that necessarily implies that there are limits on what others can do to unduly burden him in his ability to do his job. So all that the special needs standard does is ensure that a prosecutor really needs the president's information before he can enforce that subpoena. Since if he can't even show that he really needs the information, he's necessarily imposing an undue burden on the president and creating a serious risk of harassment. And if you multiply that by 2,300 prosecutors across the country, I think that the risk to the presidency is quite obvious. In terms of the Nixon case, we are actually arguing for the same standard that the court applied in the Nixon case, the special needs standard. We're just saying that a local prosecutor in state court should be, at a minimum, be required to meet the same standard that the federal prosecutor in Nixon had to meet and show that he really does need the information that he's seeking. Since, again, if he doesn't, it's unnecessarily.
Yes, Your Honor. The grand jury is an investigatory body. It doesn't make, at the outset, specific charging decisions while the investigation is underway. It investigates in order to determine, should there be specific charging decisions? But you would have them make charging decision before they investigate, and that seems to be backward.
Your Honor, respectfully, no. I would simply urge that you apply the same standard that Judge Wald applied in the Inree Fields case, which was a grand jury subpoena issued to the White House, where she concluded properly, in our view, that Nixon's special needs standard ought to apply to grand jury subpoenas. It's not, you don't have to make a charging decision, but you do have to show a demonstrated, specific, particularized need for the information pursuant to which you are issuing the grand jury subpoena.
Justice Breyer?
Thank you. General, I think that Nixon tape case has one thing for you, one thing against you. The thing against you, I think it was a case where executive privilege was asserted. But what's for you, and I think might be more relevant, is in that case, the court said, well, there has been first a weighing of the burdensome nature, et cetera, a lot of other things in that, in the lower courts that have decided that it is appropriate to go forward. Now, what I don't see is why you need a special standard more than that here, the ordinary standard. You would need a decision by us that it's reviewable in federal court. I understand that. But I don't see why you have to go beyond that, where the things you're talking about would be taken into account.
Your Honor, you are absolutely correct that at a minimum we would need federal court review, And in that regard, I would note that the district attorney here agrees that there are Article II limits on what he can do and that those Article II limits are in federal court. But respectfully, I would suggest that Nixon stands for more than simply some kind of weighing of interest. Nixon applied the special needs standard, and it said that the prosecutor did, in fact, have to show a particularized need for the information. That's all that we're suggesting ought to apply.
Yeah, but wasn't that in the context of assertion of executive privilege?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Wasn't that in the context of an assertion by the president of executive privilege?
Yes, Your Honor, it was, but litigation about private conduct is also burdensome, and as the court recognized in Clinton against Jones, the president might well need more protection in state court than he gets in federal court, precisely because of the risk of local prejudice, and that's why the court reserved judgment on that question. So I think when you put those two things together, it does make it entirely appropriate to hold a local prosecutor in state court to the same standard as the federal prosecutor was held to in the Nixon case. And indeed, even if you were to take the district attorney's own case-specific test, I think you would need the special needs standard. After all, we don't typically get discovery into a grand jury proceeding. So the only way to assess at the front end whether the prosecutor is issuing an unduly burdensome subpoena or issuing a subpoena in bad faith is to require some kind of showing of special need. After all, why would a local...
Justice Alito?
General, could you explain in more specific terms how you think this showing of special need would be carried out in district court? I assume that the prosecutor would have to make some kind of... would have to reveal what was being investigated and why this particular information was needed for or essential for the investigation. Now, would that be done, would that be reviewed by the judge ex parte? Would it be available to whoever the sitting president is to object to that, to review it and object to it?
Your Honor, it's difficult to answer that question in a vacuum because I think it would very much depend on the particular case, but let me make my best stab at it. I think that in order to have meaningful judicial review, you would need the prosecutor would need to make public as much as could responsibly be made public so that the president would have an opportunity and the president's lawyers would have an opportunity to make their case on the particular facts. If there is a certain amount of evidence that really cannot responsibly be made public, then I think it would be appropriate to consider ex parte proceedings or filings under seal. In all events, we think that that's the type of assessment that needs to be made when you're talking about subpoenas, unprecedented subpoenas like this one, that are from state and local prosecutors targeting the President of the United States. The other place I would point you to is, again, Judge Wald's very good opinion for the D.C. Circuit in the In Re Field case, where she does walk through in some amount of detail and unpack how the special needs standard applies to grand jury subpoenas.
How essential must the information be in order to meet this special needs standard? Does it have to be absolutely indispensable, not available from any other source by any conceivable means, or simply very useful?
Your Honor, it's probably somewhere in between those two things. I think it's got to be critical to the charging decision, so it can't just be marginally useful or, you know, merely duplicative or interesting to a tangential side issue. It does have to be critical to the charging decision. If the information is readily available elsewhere, I don't see how a prosecutor could meet the special needs standard. And if the information he currently does have is sufficient for him to make a responsible charging decision, I also don't think he could meet the special needs standard. So I guess I would put it somewhere.
Justice Sotomayor?
General, there's always danger in taking a doctrine adopted for one set of needs, and that has to do with needs that are balancing what is clearly recognized in law as executive privilege versus the needs for the proceeding at issue, and transplanting it to a situation that's totally different, where we're not talking about a claim of executive privilege, and we're not talking of executive immunity. We're talking about private activities that predated the president's tenure. So why are we using all that transplanted language, and why don't we get to a standard that takes care of what you're worried about, which is harassment and interference, and simply ask whether the investigation is based on credible suspicion of criminal activity and whether the subpoena is reasonably calculated to advance that investigation. A standard that looks to whether there is a good faith basis for the state prosecutor's actions and whether the subpoena is reasonable in its scope and burdens. I don't understand why that sort of standard